Welcome to a special episode of the Clinical Oncology Podcast. My name is Saif Ahmed. On March the 11th, 2011, Japan suffered arguably one of the most dramatic natural disasters in living memory. Sadly, almost 16,000 people lost their lives, and more than 2,000 people are still unaccounted for following a 9.0 magnitude earthquake off the Pacific coast of Tohoku, Japan, which led to a tsunami with waves measuring over 40 meters in height. As if this wasn't enough, soon it became clear that several nuclear reactors within the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant had suffered major damage, leading to the emergency evacuation of hundreds of thousands of people within its vicinity. 5 years on, the effects of that day are still being felt by thousands of people within Japan. Our April issue is a special issue entitled Fukushima 5 Years On and focuses on the nuclear incident at the Daiichi plant, what actually happened, and what can be learned. In our podcast, we'll first be speaking to Professor Jerry Thomas, who edited this excellent issue. She is the Chair of Molecular Pathology at Imperial College London, and one of her primary research interests is in understanding the molecular pathology of radiation-induced thyroid cancers. She also leads on tissue biobanking initiatives, including tissue related to the Chernobyl incident. Jerry had in fact also guest edited a special issue on the Chernobyl incident back in 2011, which if you haven't read already, is also well worth looking at. Following our interview with Jerry, in which she talks about what she's learned editing the Fukushima special issue, we speak with Mr. Richard Oppenheim and Dr. Keith Franklin, currently based at the British Embassy at Tokyo, to get a vivid first-hand perspective on what it was like living through the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear incident. And we'll also learn why the tsunami only affected the Daiichi plant to such an extent, and not other nuclear plants that also lay in the wake of the tsunami. And finally, we have a hugely insightful interview with Professor Otsura Niwa, who played a key role in the recovery phase at Fukushima, helping the inhabitants of the area near the incident regain their livelihoods. And in that interview, we also hear about long-term health effects in these individuals not directly caused by the radiation, such as obesity and hypertension. First, our interview with Professor Jerry Thomas.
So, Jerry, can you start off by telling us what the reader should be looking out for in this special issue?
I think you should be looking to see if you can take from this lessons that we need to learn in the case of another nuclear accident. Hopefully, there will not be another nuclear accident. And to be honest, what happened at Fukushima was a complete freak. There were three things that combined to cause the issues there, one being the earthquake, the second being the tsunami, which was much bigger than anybody had expected, and then, of course, the accident at the plant itself. It's interesting that most of the reactors did actually shut down quite normally in Japan elsewhere along that coastline, but it was the issue was being able to cool a reactor that caused the problem there, and that was a direct result of the tsunami. And I think we need to look again about how we deal with populations that are exposed to any toxin. We think of radiation as being special. It's not. It's just another toxin that our bodies are exposed to. And if we think about how we would deal with a chemical exposure, we would tell people to stay indoors and shelter, and then if we needed to, we would evacuate them when it was safe to do so. And I think with radiation, we tend to have this schizophrenic attitude to it. We understand that it's around us. We understand that sometimes we use it in medicine. But we're really scared if we're exposed to something from a nuclear accident, because I think we equate it with an atomic bomb. And yet the doses are very, very different. The dose that you get from an atomic bomb is obviously going to be much, much higher, but the doses you get from a nuclear accident are incredibly low. But we react as if they're very high. And so I think we need to understand that those doses are not what perhaps we perceive them to be, and we need to not think about radiation as being something very special. It is just another toxin that we're exposed to, and we ought to be more moderate in our responses to it, both at the sort of governmental levels and the advice to how we deal with this, but also on a personal level, so we learn to live with it.
You've raised a number of really key issues there. Firstly, I just wanted to talk about how much we already know about how we should handle these nuclear incidents. And the clinical oncology has previously had a special issue on the Chernobyl incident. So did we learn lessons from that that were taken forward into Fukushima?
Well, sadly, we didn't learn all the lessons we should have done. It was ironic that Fukushima happened when it did, because that special edition was published on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl, which was in April of 2011. And one of the things that we actually put in an editorial to that is, we have learned an awful lot from Chernobyl, but we haven't learned probably the most important thing, and that was how to communicate about the risk of exposure from very low levels of radiation, which is what happened post-Chernobyl. We did learn that children were most at risk from getting thyrocancer from the iodine in the fallout. We did learn that if we gave stable iodine, which we already knew, if we gave stable iodine, it would block the thyroid. We have interesting data from Chernobyl that suggests that the doses from cesium, although cesium is a long-lived isotope in the environment, has a long physical half-life of about 30 years, actually in the body it has a half-life of about 100 days, and the doses, therefore, that you get from cesium are very low. So although we worry about radioactive contamination of cesium in food because it's there for a long while, actually the doses we receive, and therefore the health effects, are, well, in fact, we haven't actually seen any. But they are very much more minor than something like iodine, which is there in the environment for a shorter period of time. But because it has also a short physical half-life and a long biological half-life, it actually gives a higher dose to our tissues. So we need to sort of adjust our thinking and not think that all radioisotopes are the same. How they behave in the body is key to the likely health effects we're going to see from them. And we did learn some of that from Chernobyl. But we still haven't, I don't think, got that message over to the public in particular. And even now, when you go to Japan, people are worried about cesium contamination in food, when all the evidence that we have from Chernobyl suggests that actually it's not an issue in terms of health. There are many other things that we expose ourselves to, cigarette smoke, obesity, you know, our general lifestyle, which is far more dangerous to our health than being exposed to a very small amount of radiation.
And focusing on the handling of Fukushima, one of the topics raised within the special issue is about the evacuation and handling that. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's always difficult to say what was the right way, because at the time there was very little information about what was happening. People were very scared, and I'm sure people worked in the ways that they thought were in the best interest of the people there. But that said, it's quite obvious when you look at the paper by Hasegawa, which I think is a very honest and very frank paper, that it maybe could have been done better. But at the time, there was sort of a necessity to act. And I think the one thing we should learn is that if we treated radiation like any other toxin and said, just shelter and we'll come and get you and evacuate you in a safe and orderly manner, that is a lot better than a knee-jerk response of, we have to get everybody out of here quickly. If you think about moving elderly, infirm, and sick people without the proper facilities to do that, that actually can be quite dangerous for them. So we need to be conscious of the fact that there is no need to rush headlong into this, and we should have properly planned evacuation. That said, of course, it's extremely difficult to make people act calmly and orderly in an emergency situation. So it is a difficult situation to manage, but I think the one thing we should learn is, radiation is like any other toxin. Stay inside, keep your windows and doors shut, and you'll be perfectly fine. And then you can be evacuated safely once plans are in place to take care of any special needs that you have. So I think that is something that we really should learn from that accident, which I don't think we had the opportunity to learn from Chernobyl, because it was quite a different scenario there. It was not easy to organise evacuation post-Chernobyl, and it was done much later on in the emergency situation. Whereas the Japanese did this very, very quickly, but with hindsight, probably could have taken more time over it and done it in a safer manner.
The special issue in your editorial also highlights the value of citizen science, as it were. So that's where there's an excellent article out there about children getting involved and using radiation dosimeters to measure what the doses are around where they live in other parts of Europe. So you can tell us a little bit about that. And also, I think there's an article in our special issue from someone living through the Fukushima incident.
Yeah, I think we tend to forget that we are all human. And if you think how you would maybe react in that sort of situation, I think you have a better understanding of how people are actually feeling. And I think one of the important thing is to make sure that data is always put into context. When you explain to people about the health risks from being exposed to low doses of radiation and compare that to other risks to their health that they're quite happy with, like cigarette smoking or obesity, things that are common knowledge, they suddenly realise it's not quite as dangerous as they thought. And I think there's a great role to be played with citizen science in this, making people more aware, giving them the power to see what's going on for themselves, giving people dosimeters so they can monitor their own dose, but then being able to say to them, these are the sort of doses you'd find elsewhere in the world. You can't tell them what dose is safe, because we all have our own risk thresholds, but you can say to them, this is the dose you're reading, and this is the sort of normal range for around the world. This is what it was before the accident. And it gives them some form of context to put that in. If you go to Fukushima Prefecture, you'll find there's loads of monitors which give you a reading of what the airborne radiation is. Now, I wouldn't have a clue what those numbers meant, and I suspect I know a bit more about radiation than most people. So many people will be concerned by that. But if you were actually say, well, that number is that, but actually normally it's this, or in some other place, it's this value, it gives the data some context. And it's interesting you should pick up the article that the children wrote. I actually had the privilege of working with a group of 17-year-olds from Japan, paired with 17-year-olds from the UK on a week-long residential course in Cambridge. And I gave them a task of looking at the media in English and in Japanese, to see how different the presentation of what was happening after Fukushima was. And it's nice to have children because they see things that we don't see as adults. And they picked up the fact the Japanese press are very good at reporting facts, but there's no context to them because it's difficult for the Japanese media to find scientists who are willing to talk to them. It generally is scientists who will put them into those facts into context. And it was in quite measured language. But when you look at the English media, and by that I mean English and American, you could see quite clearly, yeah, the facts were there, the interpretation was there, they found some scientists to talk to, but the language was so emotive. And unfortunately, we respond to emotive language very much. So if you have the facts, the interpretation, and then some highly emotive words behind it, the impression you get from it is very different from if that language is quite moderate. And so people refer to disaster rather than accident. A disaster can mean different things to different people. And I've spoken to journalists in the past about their use of high levels of radiation. Well, what do you mean by a high level of radiation? If you don't give me any context to that, I can take it several different ways. So I think empowering people to see for themselves is a very good way of helping people live with a situation. And they've done that in many parts of Japan, and the communities themselves have ways of monitoring their food. And when you say to them, have you ever had to throw away food because it was contaminated? They go, oh, no, it doesn't register anything. But we still like to be able to measure it for ourselves and see for ourselves. So I think that sort of empowerment is key to helping people come to terms with the situation and learn to live with what has happened, because we all have to do that eventually.
That's all really fascinating. And I wanted to now ask, you spent much of your career trying to understand the health effects of radiation on people. So what are the active questions that we're asking at the moment, and what future research areas do you see coming onto the horizon in the next few years?
Well, one of the major things is, if tumours arise as a result of being exposed to radiation, are they any different from tumours that would arise from any of the other toxins that we're exposed to? And we're exposed to a lot of them in life. And the jury is still very much out in that. There is currently a whole study looking at whole genome sequencing in the States using material from the Chernobyl Tissue Bank, which I hope will maybe answer that question once and for all. We've learned a lot from the Chernobyl tumours, the major one being that childhood thyroid cancer is actually molecularly quite different from adult onset thyroid cancer, which raises all sorts of interesting paths you could go down to look at the comparison of pediatric tumours versus mature onset tumours. And the other area, of course, of research is thyroid cancer going to be the only thing we see post-Chernobyl? My guess is it is. If you look at the doses, the chances are that you're going to see very little in a population that was really only exposed to the equivalent of a CT scan over a period of 25 years. And that's the sort of a level that we're talking about. In Japan, they've taken a slightly different approach. They think it would be helpful to the population to know their health was being monitored. And it's interesting how different cultures would respond differently to that. So some people, I suspect, would be, if you're monitoring my health, then something's going to happen to me. Whereas others might feel that quite comforting. So there's a huge health survey, which will give absolutely masses of data about the general health of the population. It's a great chance to get a load of data about the Japanese population and to see if we can find diseases that we could monitor much more effectively and things like that. But that doesn't mean it's going to relate anything to the radiation, because the radiation from Fukushima was so low that all the major reports agree that there will be no discernible health effects in terms of the actual interaction of the radiation with the tissue. In terms of the psychological impact of being exposed to radiation, there will be huge impacts on that society. And it's important that we monitor those and we capture them, because we've actually created that by the way we responded to the accident. I mean, we in the general sense of the term, because the world's media were there. That obviously was fed into what people feel. So I think we are all culpable to a certain degree about the way that that accident has particularly affected that population. I think there's a lot of scope for research, but I think we also have to think ethically whether actually we do good or harm by monitoring a population that's being exposed like that. And there are lots of questions being raised about, should we carry on monitoring the Sami people, for example, in the Nordic countries, the reindeer herders who had quite higher levels of cesium because of the diet they have. I think there's lots of ethical research that needs to go on, and I think there's an awful lot of scientific data that will come out of the studies, both post-Chernobyl and post-Fukushima.
Jerry, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, and also thank you for editing such an excellent special issue on such a complex area. Really appreciate it.
Next, we speak to Mr. Richard Oppenheim and Dr. Keith Franklin, who are both currently based at the British Embassy in Tokyo. Their interview offers a first-hand perspective of events during the Fukushima incident and details how the British government dealt with the evolving events at that time, and also some of the big challenges around risk communication.
Richard and Keith, thank you very much for joining us all the way from Tokyo. Can you start off by briefly introducing yourselves and telling us what your roles are at the British Embassy and whether that's any different to what your roles were at the time of the incident?
Yes, certainly. I'm Richard Oppenheim. I'm currently the political counsellor dealing with foreign and security policy in the embassy. But at the time of the incident, the earthquake in March 2011, I had just started as the head of our climate change and energy team. And I was heavily involved in the response, travelling up to the affected areas, essentially doing consular and work, as well as being in charge of the information team, handling all of the information coming into us and trying to get that to the right places.
Hello, yes, I'm Keith Franklin, and I'm on secondment from the National Nuclear Laboratory to the embassy here in Tokyo. The main part of my job is looking at where the UK can support the decommissioning and cleanup operation at Fukushima Daiichi. But at the time of the accident, I was actually in Gloucestershire in the NNL, helping to provide technical advice to the government, which actually fed into the work that the likes of Richard were doing over here in Japan at the time of the accident.
Richard, can you remind us what happened that day?
Yeah, so it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, as I remember it, and we were all sitting at our desks working, and there was an earthquake. There had been a few earthquakes in the days leading up to it, so it wasn't particularly unusual. But it had been going on for maybe 20 or 30 seconds, and we realised it was going to be a long one. And I personally remember walking into the room next to mine and suggesting to the team that we might need to put our hats on. We all have hard hats under our desks, and that's what we did. And it got stronger and stronger, and we all ended up under our desks and computers falling off surfaces, cupboards falling over. It was pretty dramatic. And then after that, we all left the building, and there was an announcement encouraging us to do that. We all stood on the ambassador's lawn, which is the big space that we all safely can go to in an earthquake. And I remember the first aftershock was so powerful that we all had to sit down because we couldn't stand up. When that came 10 or 15 minutes after the original earthquake, we were then sort of into semi-crisis mode straight away, working out what was going on. The ambassador at the time was about 30 kilometres away in Yokohama at a meeting. So the deputy head of mission was sort of in charge, and I was working with him to try and get people into groups and work out who was missing and who was with us. And then we were into things like contacting schools and setting up our crisis centre. So we decided that one of the other buildings in the embassy was safe to move back into. We did that. And we had a big TV screen, and we were watching all the pictures that you were seeing of the tsunami coming in on Japanese TV by the time that it actually happened, half an hour or 20 minutes after the earthquake happened. And then we were into contacting authorities to try and find out what was going on, contacting staff and families to try and make sure that they were accounted for. And then, obviously, into the business of trying to work out where UK citizens were and how we could help them. So time went past very quick. Before we knew it, it was evening, doing all those things. And we were starting to talk about the first group of people who would travel up to the affected areas and how we would deploy them, make sure that they were safe while they were there and decide what they should do while they were there. So those are the first few hours as I remember them. But it was all quite traumatic and quite difficult to take in, to the scale of it. It was pretty hard to fathom. And this was before the Fukushima accident began unfolding. Again, a lot of it live on TV as it was happening.
You mentioned about the earthquake, then the tsunami, and then the nuclear incident. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened in that nuclear power plant?
Yeah, there were, as you described, there were three big events, the earthquake, then the tsunami, and then the accident. But throughout the time after the earthquake, there were regular aftershocks. And these were big earthquakes in themselves. And they were very regular. They were every 5 minutes. There was an aftershock. So most of us experienced earthquake sickness, where you don't really know whether you're moving or not, because there's so many aftershocks that it's hard to know. And it did feel like we were living in a crisis for the next couple of weeks, with a lot of food not being available. Bottled water went very quickly out of circulation. And we were having electrical problems, so there were rolling blackouts in different parts of Tokyo, mostly because of the accident. A lot of the power in Tokyo actually came from the Fukushima Daiichi site. Daini, which is next door, also has 6 reactors, and those were shut down at the time as well. So there was suddenly not enough power for Tokyo, and that also made us feel like we were in a crisis scenario. In terms of what happened, I'll let you talk a bit about it, because you know from a technical perspective.
Yeah, so what the Daiichi accident actually was, and actually it's important to remember that Fukushima is actually the name of the prefecture or the state where the power station is. The power station itself is called Fukushima Daiichi. And what happened was that during the earthquake, all the power stations shut down automatically, as they were supposed to do. But then when the tsunami hit about half an hour later, what it actually did was knock out the backup power generators on the site. And what had happened in the earthquake is that the off-site electrical power, which came in onto the site and ran the cooling pumps, had been cut off. So that had been cut off, but they had backup generators, they kicked in. The tsunami then hit them, knocked them out of commission, but that was okay because actually they had backup batteries to run the cooling pumps. And the backup batteries lasted for between 8 and 12 hours. And the expectation had always been that if the batteries were needed, 8 to 12 hours was enough time to get everything else back up and running. But unfortunately, due to the infrastructure damage due to the earthquake and tsunami, it meant they couldn't actually get the generators and all the other things back up running in time. So the cooling pumps stopped working, and a nuclear power reactor is sort of like a car. It's nothing like a car at all, but it's sort of like a car when you need to keep cooling it. And even if you turn it off, just like you turn off a car, the engine stays hot for some time. So these cooling pumps, even though the reactors had been turned off, needed to be kept operating. They weren't operating. The reactors slowly got hotter and hotter and hotter. Steam was produced, and the steam then reacted with some of the metal inside the reactor and produced hydrogen. The hydrogen eventually exploded. And those things that you saw on TV, were actually hydrogen explosions happening due to hydrogen produced as a result of a reaction between steam and zirconium. So that's the technical reason for the accident and why it progressed the way it did.
Thank you very much for that. I'm sure a lot of people didn't really have a handle on that at that time, watching things on the TV. And it was a time the big fear was of the nuclear power plant would lead to a much bigger loss of life. So at that time, what was the British Embassy's role?
So at that time, we were focused on the welfare of British nationals, which in any crisis like this is our job, and we do this around the world. So we treated this exactly the same. We have a very clear protocol for setting up crisis centre. We have roles that have been predefined and decided, and we drill and train so that we're ready to respond to any crisis, if and when it occurs. So in this case, this is obviously a major crisis. So very quickly, we were in touch with the Foreign Office. They set up a hotline for families of those living in Japan who are concerned. Of course, the tsunami was huge in its devastation, several hundred square kilometres of Japan's northeastern coast. Lots of British people living in those areas. And we had some idea of who was there, but obviously it depends on people registering with us to know exactly who's there. And so the contact with relatives in the UK is very important, and that information was crucial for us as we deployed into those areas. We also very quickly asked for backup, so more people to come to Japan from other parts of the region and from London, what we call rapid deployment teams, to come and support our efforts. And that started happening. First rapid deployment team arrived on the 12th of March. First of all, our ambassador needed to come back to the embassy. He was in Yokohama, but it took 7 hours. Normally a half an hour trip took 7 hours for him to get back because of the traffic. Traffic was absolutely gridlocked, as you can probably imagine, with all of the power problems and the level of the earthquake, and even in Tokyo, was big enough that there had been damage to buildings and so forth. So we were very quickly talking to experts and UK ministers from here about how quickly we could deploy, and went up there. The first team went up, I think it was that night actually, certainly the next day. And then other teams gradually followed. And we made a base in a hotel in Sendai, which was near the centre of the earthquake, and began looking for British people who were living in Iwate and Miyagi prefectures, which were the ones that were hardest hit by the tsunami.
An interesting side effect, which Richard talked about, the gridlock that was in Tokyo at the time. This resulted in lots of people actually walking home because the trains were out because there was no electricity, and the traffic lights were here, there and everywhere. And so walking was the best option. And people walked for up to 12 hours to get home. But this actually resulted in queues outside sports shops because, of course, people had come to work wearing their working shoes, and especially ladies were wearing perhaps not shoes that were appropriate for an 8-hour yomp back to your house. And actually, there were queues outside these shops to buy sports shoes and boots and all that kind of thing just for the walk home. Not something you would anticipate, but that's the sort of thing that was happening.
And it was quite cold. I mean, it was actually snowing up in the areas that were affected, and it was still pretty cold in Tokyo. So there was an issue with making sure that people were warm enough. Even just for the first half an hour when we were out on the ambassador's lawn, we were trying to make sure that people were warm enough. We then, once we got up to Sendai, it was all about trying to find people. So it was a process of using the information we had. We had a list of sort of high priority people who we thought were most likely to have been affected. We had a list of those names, and we were going to the areas where there were sort of addresses listed. Now, often those addresses didn't exist anymore, or they were very badly damaged. So we would go to the nearest evacuation centre. And the Japanese authorities had already set up evacuation centres in the areas that had been affected, and that was where people were gathering to get food and drink and shelter. So we would travel to those places. In my team, I was the only person speaking Japanese, so I would be looking through the list in Japanese of names that had been registered, trying to find foreign names or British names. We would make announcements at those places sometimes to try and get people to bring themselves forward if they were British. And then we would offer them a way out, you know, an opportunity to come back to Tokyo. So after about 5 days of doing that, we were able to gather about 100 British people who wanted to travel to Tokyo, either to stay in Tokyo or to leave Japan. and we hired a couple of buses and we brought them back to Tokyo. By that stage, we had to do it via the very long route around the mountains of Niigata, because the Fukushima accident meant that there was an 80-kilometer exclusion zone around the nuclear plant, which blocked our five-hour route back. So it took 14 hours. We left at midday and we got back at 4 o'clock in the morning the following day with the first two busloads of people. And, yeah, it was a long, difficult trip, blizzard conditions. There was not much food or water available, not much petrol available, very hard to get hold of all of those sorts of things because people were buying all of that stuff up in bulk. So it's quite a tough journey. And then we had people's families, cats, dogs, all sorts of things on the buses, all wanting to get away and carry on with their lives.
And at that time, aside from the risk of potential aftershocks and further earthquakes, was the situation at the nuclear power plant felt to be under control? Had people predicted what was going to happen and they were happy with the exclusion zone, or were people planning for a worst case scenario?
There was a lot of worry and people didn't really know what was happening. A lot of the things that happened that Keith described earlier, the explosions, for example, they were shown live on TV in real time. So you had a situation where people were watching explosions at a nuclear plant, and then they wanted to know what was happening, and nobody could confirm exactly what was happening that quickly. And so there were some very awkward TV interviews with mostly nuclear engineers who just weren't able to say what was going on. Of course, they weren't trained communicators either, so it came across very badly on the TV, and it looked as though the government and TEPCO, who were in charge at the plant, didn't really know what was happening and weren't really in control. I think it's come out since then that there were some very brave people working on the plant, and lots of people knew what they were doing, although it was a very difficult situation, was unfolding, and various methods were tried to try and keep control of the situation. We obviously were monitoring the levels of radiation in Tokyo, but we were obviously relying on the Japanese data, which we believed to be accurate, and it proved later that we were right, it was accurate data that was coming out. I think the big challenge was that partly because of the people who were having to give these statements publicly, who weren't really trained in those communication skills, a lot of the information was very difficult for the average person to understand. So there was a lot of talk in the media about things being X thousand times normal level, and people very quickly had to learn about becquerels and millisieverts and microsieverts, and nobody knew what those were to start off with, and there was no real comparison, and there was no one saying this is the effect on health, or this might be 10,000 times normal levels, but actually still within safe limits. So I think that was the beginnings of the challenge around communication about radiation. So people worried about the food chain, worried about water and how water, not just in Fukushima, but in Tokyo as well, might be affected. So that was why the bottled water sold out very quickly. And then there were people also concerned, obviously, about radiation itself, particularly people living close to Fukushima. I spoke to several people who were living quite close to the plant, some of whom decided to stay because of family and so forth, who were worried about the risks to their health. And that was where John Beddington and the team, the SAGE team in the UK, came in, really, and we were very reliant on their excellent advice.
There were other nuclear reactors caught up in the tsunami. Why was it that none of those incurred the same large-scale problems as those that happened at the Fukushima Daiichi plant?
Why did the accident happen at Fukushima Daiichi and not at Daini or at one of the other plants further up the coast that was also hit with a big tsunami? And I suppose there were probably two reasons. One was the height of the wall, which at Fukushima Daiichi was lower than at the other places. Daini had a similar height wall, so they did get inundated with water. But the difference between Daiichi and Daini was that at Daiichi, the backup power was located underground, whereas at Daini, it was in a high ground position and they were able to use it.
What Richard said is right up to a point, and what happened at Daini that was different was that one off-site power line remained intact And what they were able to do was lay a whole load of cable in very, very quick time from that one power line. So actually, quite a lot of the off-site power lines did get knocked over, but one of them survived. They laid a whole load of cable in very quick time, which got the pumps up and running again and allowed the coolant to happen. So that's what happened there. But there are some other success stories, as Richard described. On a Gawa plant, which is further up the coast, everything worked. The coolant powers the reserve, the safety systems kicked into place and it shut down safely, as did another 17 power plants in the Tohoku area.
So I mean, the wider point about this is that in 2007, when the IAEA came to inspect Fukushima Daiichi, they actually suggested that the backup power should be located on higher ground, and that was ignored. Fukushima Daiichi is one of Japan's oldest plants. I suppose from a company perspective, it felt like there was less value in doing it. But I think that's a sort of lesson as well in terms of having regulations and making sure that those kinds of peer suggestions are heeded and acted on. And very quickly after the earthquake and the accident, there was a move to create a new nuclear regulator in Japan, which has been stood up and has been working very hard. New sets of regulations, I think, is creating a new culture in Japan on nuclear safety.
And you've already referred to some of the challenges in terms of risk communication and potentially some of the lessons learned. So overall from that incident, what do you think were the biggest lessons learned?
Well, I mean, I'll ask Keith to say something as well. But for me, I think in terms of the communications, I think one of them was keep it simple. And there needs to be some explanation or interpretation of data, because the average person isn't going to understand 10,000 becquerels or whatever. You need to explain what that means, and you need to explain it and relate it to risks to health and to life very simply and very quickly and very clearly. I think there's a responsibility for media as well to consult people who have real expertise, and there was quite a lot of people who didn't really have expertise but wanted to say things being given airtime on media, and I think that made things worse because it confused the messages. And there were some good messages out there in the media, but they were being mixed up with messages that were from people who weren't real experts, and I think that was a challenge as well. And I suppose the other big lesson, and it's a lesson more widely for the whole, in terms of the whole situation, Japan coped remarkably well with what was really three big crises happening simultaneously. But having structures that are well drilled and prepared to deal with these kinds of situations, I think our own structure that we used in that crisis situation, the SAGE group, was a good example of how effective that can be, and having those structures can be. And it wasn't just us that was reliant on the advice that was being provided by the SAGE group. It was a lot of Japanese people were listening in and using the advice as well, because they wanted to have some second opinion or something that they could trust. So it was very interesting to hear about that afterwards, about how useful it was to Japanese people as well as to our own British nationals.
Yeah, I think what some of the lessons that would be learned about is what is the advice people want, as Richard described. Who actually gives that advice? Because it doesn't matter what the type of accident. Ignore the fact it was a nuclear accident for the moment. Imagine there was an industrial accident somewhere by some company. Actually, because the company's had the accident, they're probably not the best people to give the advice. Even if they actually know it and what they're giving is correct, they're unlikely to be the best people from a communications point of view to explain and be trusted by the public. So who's going to be giving that message? I would suspect an independent scientist or a government regulator or somebody like that is giving the message. So what do people want to know? Who is it that's actually saying it? And actually, from the nuclear industry's point of view, I think the thing that came out of it most is that there's a mutual suspicion, should I say, between the nuclear industry and the media. And many people in the industry don't like talking to the media because they feel they'll twist their words, etc. But what that does, it allows people who are slightly outside and perhaps with not so much knowledge to jump into that vacuum and give their opinions on things. And so that doesn't help. So I think the relationship between the nuclear industry and the media, even if there's no accident, just needs to be better. And I think people are starting to do that. I also think that, as we wrote in the article, the time of a nuclear accident is not the time to start teaching people about radiation. And some of the explanations were all about alpha, beta, gamma, penetration rates, all this kind of stuff. And sure, that's very interesting, but right at the time of the accident, people just want to know, is it okay or not? Is it damaging my health or not? Now, I think that a basic understanding of radiation, just like we all have a basic understanding of electricity, we don't have to shove a fork in a socket in the wall, we know that. And basic understanding of radiation, that it's all around us, that things you can do if there's that kind of stuff, just should be something we all know. It's part of our lives. Nuclear power is going to be around for a very long time. I would say that's a lesson to be learned from it as well.
Thank you very much for that. So in your opinions, how well is the UK prepared for a similar type of scenario in terms of communication and all the other challenges that you talked about?
Well, I mean, I think the way that the UK responded to this accident suggests that we're in a pretty good shape. We were able to advise UK citizens on whether to leave or not. This was the big question for a lot of countries. Many other countries, including some European countries, left Tokyo and advised their nationals to leave Japan. We didn't do that. As I said earlier, we actually increased in number. The advice the SAGE group was giving us was based on some very carefully made calculations about the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario, in very layman's terms, was meltdown at the reactors, a plastic cloud gets thrown up into the sky and blown very quickly by a fast wind down to Tokyo, and then it rains for 2 or 3 days in Tokyo. That was the worst case scenario in terms of Tokyo, where so many people live. Based on that worst case scenario, the team calculated that if you were to take an iodine pill at the right times, if you were under 40, that would be enough to protect you from damage from the radiation. And staying indoors and closing doors and windows and taking those kind of precautions would be enough, so they didn't affect health. So we actually arranged for large quantities of iodine pills. We gave those out to people in Tokyo with the advice that we would tell them if they needed to take them and what to do. Obviously, that we didn't come to that situation, but that was what we needed to do to help our citizens. And I think we knew that because we had the systems to bring the experts together and produce that kind of analysis.
Yeah, I think if you would ignore it was a nuclear accident for the moment, and just following up what Richard said there, and a big incident that affects lots of people. So it's a train crash, it's a plane crash, it's an explosion at a chemical factory, whatever it is, there are drills and systems in place to deal with those things. There's a gold, silver and bronze command system. People do exercises and all that kind of thing. So the UK is as prepared. Obviously, you can never be absolutely perfectly prepared, but there are systems in place in order to do that. One of the issues at Daiichi was that, as I described before, it came to the end of the manual, if you like. So the manual said if the power gets cut off, the generators will kick in. If the generator doesn't work, the batteries will kick in. If the batteries don't work, well, the generators will be back on by then. It got to the end of that, and it wasn't clear who was to make the next call. I think that was certainly something that's been reported independently about the accident.
If I can just add on nuclear safety as well, just to say in terms of the UK response, one of the responses was very quickly for the Secretary of State to ask for Dr. Mike Waitman, who was the Chief Nuclear Inspector at the time, to commission draft a report on the lessons learned for the UK from the accident and whether it should affect our own nuclear policy. And he very quickly got together an interim report and then a final report later that year. He had a particularly special insight because he was the head of an IAEA delegation of nuclear experts who visited the plant in April, very soon after the accident, to take stock. So he had a real insight into what was going on, the reasons behind the accident, and used that to help with the report, which the conclusion of which was that there were things we could learn about defence in depth and stress testing, which is something that's happened in the 5 years since then, but that there was no need to change our plans for building nuclear plants in the UK, for example, or our policies on nuclear, because our approach to safety was such that we had sort of envisaged these kinds of things happening and how we'd respond if they did.
Yeah, and this report is actually available on the Office for Nuclear Regulation website. And although the large earthquakes and tsunamis are unlikely in the UK, it's almost the fact it was a large earthquake and tsunami isn't important. it was the impact was that it cut off site power, and other things can cut off site power. So, you know, the stress testing on that, what the backup plans are and all that kind of thing. Obviously the industry's responded to that. So it's, if you want to have a look at it, that's the place people can go and check it out.
Richard and Keith, thank you very much for such an insightful discussion. Really appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you. Thanks.
Finally, we speak with Professor Otsura Niwa. His research has focused on understanding the effects of radiation on living organisms, and his distinguished career has led to him working with a number of important international organizations. Professor Niwa has served as the president of the International Association for Radiation Research and is also a senior member of the ICRP, the International Commission on Radiological Protection. In addition, he serves on the Council of the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, based in Hiroshima, Japan, which succeeded the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission and is an organization focused on understanding the health effects of atomic bomb radiation. Having been appointed an emeritus professor at Kyoto University, he is now also based at Fukushima Medical University, and he is thus able to deliver a truly unique and fascinating insight into the incident that took place there. I understood that much of his primary responsibilities around the time of the Fukushima incident were through his position at the ICRP. So I started by asking what the ICRP's role was just after the events at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, particularly in those areas just outside the evacuation zone.
The situation in Fukushima turned out to be exactly what's been described in publication 111 of ICRP's publication, that is, recovery phase document.
The 111 document Professor Niwa mentioned is freely available online. It's a very comprehensive 70-page PDF and details in its own words the Commission's recommendations to the protection of people living in long-term contaminated areas after a nuclear accident or a radiation emergency. It's sobering to think that such documents exist, let alone that they may actually have to be used. Professor Niwa then went on to explain how this recovery phase is best managed.
Authority handled the initial stage of the accident, and that happens anywhere, and it's the governmental responsibility to do that. But when time goes by, the area should have to be handed to the people living there. And for that, people have to move forward and with good spirit. Otherwise, recovery is impossible. And 111 deals with one important point, that is stakeholders' involvement. Stakeholders' involvement means people who will be living there will take proactive actions to improve the quality of life in the land which get affected by radiation. To do the proactive action, they have to have a confidence on themselves, and they have to have a confidence on the situation. That is, they have confidence to self-control the situation. And at the time of accident, people fear, and people don't know how to handle the case. And that means, you know, their mind goes onto the negative spiral. But in order for these people to live, they have to protect themselves in this land. And so they have to live with radiation eventually. And I'm not really telling to live with radiation which is harmful to their health. In the case of Fukushima, fortunately, the dose was not that high. So what we did after the accident was we went into Fukushima and then started having so-called dialogue seminar where we have local people and local experts and experts from outside, and then have discussion sessions. It's not teaching or lecturing anything. So local people express themselves and professionals may just talk about their knowledge. And by doing this kind of meeting from time to time, we might be able to to gain trust from these people. Only then we can discuss much about how you can tackle on this problem of radiation. The most primary element of controlling the situation is to know the situation. That is dosimetry. And we work together and just measure the dose together, and we can measure the dose of outside of Fukushima as well and compare why this dose is so and that high or low or what. And that way people know that their own situation and they start to gain the confidence in living in their land. I'm talking about the place where people didn't have to evacuate, fortunately. But even that, in that area, people are very much afraid at the beginning. And we had this dialogue seminar 12 times in the past 4 years. And somehow, many of them came, and some of them never came back, but quite a number of them came frequently. And how to make them regain their own life of living in Fukushima, that was the issue. So that is what the ICRP was doing.
I then asked what difference ICRP's actions made to the people of Fukushima.
Eventually that place has to recover anyhow. And some people start living there. But what happened between ICRP and local people was the action of our side, definitely. And eventually it became action of both sides. And this kind of action been taking place to many places. Some actions are small, some actions are larger, but it always bottom-up kind. And if the government is trying to implement things from the top, it didn't usually work, because it's so clear that governmental authorities' approach has to rely on some kind of generic rule, which can be applied to everybody. But the life in a real situation is individual life, and which differ one by one. So this top-down policy has to be implemented at the beginning, but this top-down policy has to be replaced by the bottom-up approach eventually. And what we were doing at ICRP was to have this bottom-up way as quick as possible, although it took us quite some years. And for the case of Chernobyl, that only started to happen 10 years after the accident in southern Belarus. In the heavily contaminated area, people are evacuated zone. People are all gone to Minsk, and leftover people are felt that they are just abandoned. So situation didn't improve 10 years. And only after 10 years, EU somehow sent a team, and they started taking this kind of action. So ICRP's action was something like the actions took place in southern Belarus 10 years after the Chernobyl accident.
Next, I asked what the ICRP had learned from this experience and what could be improved if a similar incident happened again.
I think, you know, this is not really an ICRP's role, by the way, because we are a very small NPO and we don't have much money to do this.
Professor Neva then went on to explain that for the first 3 years after the incident, there was relatively little funding available for Japanese scientists like himself to work in Fukushima. Many of them were having to fund themselves. There was an influx of professionals from European organizations at that time, which was vitally important. And in fact, Professor Neva found that after a year traveling between Fukushima and Tokyo, where he was based at that time, this was no longer feasible, and he was very grateful to Fukushima Medical University, who at that point offered him a part-time position there. He mentioned that moving into Fukushima allowed him to spend more time with the people there, And this was crucial to his understanding of the situation. He stressed that it wasn't a case of him and other professionals educating the inhabitants. More so, he was learning from them. So I asked Professor Neva, what did he learn?
Very interestingly, I'm a radiation biologist. One of the basics is radiation dose. And then my understanding before Fukushima accident was radiation dose is a physical entity. Maybe 99% of people in the world say, oh, radiation dose, it's physical entity. And some more knowledgeable person may say, oh, it is measured by the amount of energy put into kilogram mass, and you can measure it, sure. But for the people in Fukushima, radiation dose doesn't mean any physical entity. It means a measure to the quality of life, which I never thought about it. So I learned a lot. This is very simple and very basic understanding I only gained after I moved into Fukushima and discussed with local people. So since you ask me what I learned, I say I learned what the dose means to the people, not to the scientists.
A truly fascinating perspective. Next, I went on to ask whether there are any actual radiation-related health risks for the people living there.
I very much doubt if there is any epidemiologically detectable increase of the risk in the area where they are living. But this doesn't mean there is no health risk at all. There is a lot of health risk coming up. Obesity, hypertension, and diabetes. They're suffering, and also they are suffering mentally. And this is not the direct consequence of radiation, but the consequence of bad living and very rough lifestyle and so forth. And kids are obese now because they've been told that they shouldn't run around outside because radiation is still there. And so kids tend to be confined and they get obese.
I had a look on the Fukushima Medical University website, and there are a host of articles highlighting health risks following the incident one wouldn't have expected. It's well worth looking at. In fact, one of these articles written by Professor Hasegawa appears in this very issue of Clinical Oncology. It's an excellent article and elaborates on some of the points Professor Niwa raised about lifestyle modifications leading to increased health risks. It also examines what lessons can be learned from the evacuation. Soberingly, although in Fukushima there were no reported deaths due to radiation, and nor are there likely to be, 60 people are known to have died during the evacuation due to the nuclear incident. In the final part of the interview, Professor Niwa expounds on what Jerry Thomas mentioned in her interview regarding the value of citizen science.
You can check a paper written by Fukushima high school students. They measured their own personal dosimetry, and they measured the dose of high school students in Japan, and they measured the dose of French high schools and Belarusian high school and Polish high school. And they compared the dose of these places. So Japan and also Europe. Highest dose they ever got is Korsika in France. And so if Fukushima is dangerous, Korsika is very dangerous.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, and I hope you also get the time to have a read of this month's excellent special issue. I'd like to thank all of our interviewees for providing such insightful and thought-provoking comments. I would also like to thank the team at the Royal College of Radiologists and Elsevier, who worked tirelessly to bring us the excellent Clinical Oncology Journal month after month. In particular, I'd also like to thank Professor Jerry Thomas and Paul Simmons, who helped bring us this excellent special issue. And also a special thank you to Kathy O'Hara, Executive Publisher at Elsevier, and Charlotte Coles, our Editor-in-Chief, for their support in developing these podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and if you have any comments, good or bad, please contact our editorial team.